the birth and death of languages. Let me begin by saying what I'm not going to talk about. It's commonly said that Latin is a dead language. It doesn't have any native speakers, but Latin didn't really die. Instead, it developed into the Romance languages, French, Italian, Spanish, and so on. And those weren't new languages. They developed out of Latin, just as Old English didn't really die. Instead, it changed into Middle English and then Modern English. We're still going to look at some other cases of birth and death of languages, although in some cases these terms are a bit controversial. I'm going to focus on the social setting in which these events take place and the effects that they have on the speakers, though there'll be a little bit of exemplification towards the end of the talk. So I'll begin by talking about the death of languages, in particular, or more generally, endangered languages and language death. Languages die, or some people prefer to talk about languages being lost, or languages becoming dormant when they no longer have any native speakers. Or some people would say that the language dies when the second to last speaker dies, because then the last speaker has nobody to talk to. At the moment, there are around 6,000 languages used in the world, and it's possible that over something like 2,500 of those will have died out by the end of this century. But that, of course, is speculation. We'll come back to the effects of the language dying out. It doesn't mean that the speakers have no one to talk to, since in most cases people are bilingual in such examples, and probably half of humans are bilingual in a way that doesn't apply to most UK residents. Okay, I'm going to look at some classifications of endangered languages, or one classification. There's more than one way of classifying endangered languages and of assigning languages to particular categories. I'll just look at the one that UNESCO have made. A language is extinct. They don't talk about languages being dead or being lost or being dormant. Instead, they use the term extinct when there are no speakers left. Then there are critically endangered languages where the youngest speakers are grandparents and they don't really speak the language all that often. I looked up a list of languages in the British Isles which are classified here, and the only example which is described as critically endangered is Manx. I'm not entirely sure that Manx does qualify under that definition, but that's the way in which it's classified by UNESCO. Then there are severely endangered languages. It's spoken by grandparents and older, and those who are younger than the grandparents, the parents may understand it, but they don't speak it to children or among themselves. I don't think there are any languages in the British Isles which are categorised as severely endangered. The nearest one is Breton, spoken in the Brittany region of France. Then there are languages which are definitely endangered. Children no longer learn the language as a mother tongue in the home. They may speak it a bit, but they don't really learn it at home. And the ones that in the British Isles that UNESCO categorises in this way are Gaelic, that's Scottish Gaelic, and also Irish, that's Irish both in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And then there are vulnerable languages. Most children speak the language, but it may be restricted to certain domains, and Welsh is classified in that way, which may be a bit controversial. And then there are the safe or not endangered languages where all generations and all ages speak it, and it's transmitted to without any trouble. And so English obviously would be an example there. I'm not going to talk about it, but there's also a list published by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, a red list of threatened species, animal and plant species, that includes, there are nine different groups that they can be extinct in the wild, critically endangered, near threatened, and so on. So there's a kind of parallel there between languages and animal and plant species. Okay, let's go on to look at the causes of language endangerment and death. And there's not just one single cause. The first one, though it's not very common, is natural disasters. Very occasionally, a language is wiped out completely because it's only spoken by a small community of people, and they are wiped out by a natural disaster such as a flood or a volcanic eruption or something. But that's not very common. There are also cases of extermination where all or nearly all the speakers of a language are killed. And one example of this was Tasmanian languages. There were probably 7 or 8 different languages spoken in Tasmania, although not a great deal is known about them. And almost all the speakers were killed, murdered, to be more honest about it, in a war in the 1820s. A few speakers did survive a bit longer, and apparently the last speaker died in the early years of the 20th century. But basically, Tasmanian languages were exterminated, and the languages there didn't really die. They were, well, if you want to use this term, they were killed. But a more likely case, more likely causes of language endangerment and death are a gradual shift over generations, where, for example, there may be a generation which only speaks the local language and the next generation or two may be bilingual in the local language and the dominant language is for reasons of education or work. Then perhaps their kids, after a generation or two, perhaps only speak the dominant language, not the local language. So there may be a gradual shift over generations, and it may be rather longer than I just made it sound. And sort of connected to that, I suppose, are the facts that empires and big national states, as it says in the quote from Andrew Dolby, large centralized political units cause the total number of languages in their territory to decline. So, for example, the Roman Empire caused a great many languages which were spoken in the sizable domain that was covered to decline, die off, whatever. And at one time, there were perhaps almost 100 languages spoken in California, but killings and conquest and so on led to the spread of, well, Spanish and then English. And so, for example, when couples that spoke different languages, different native languages, became a couple, then they would often switch to English or Spanish, and that would be the language that would be transferred to their kids and so on. So basically, disrupting people's lives can, among many other things, lead to a loss of languages. And for example, the Irish potato famine had, again, among other results, quite a big impact on the way in which Irish, on the extent to which Irish was spoken. So basically, really, languages become endangered and perhaps die when the lives of their speakers are disrupted in fairly major ways. And what are the consequences of language endangerment and death? Well, one, I'll look at a couple of them. One is the loss of botanical knowledge. Many languages, particularly those spoken, sort of minority languages spoken in sort of hunter-gatherer, etc. societies, they embody a lot of knowledge of the local environment, plants and so on. And for example, aspirin apparently was developed from a plant that was used in traditional herbal treatments. I don't know much about that, but that's the kind of thing that can happen when a language ceases to be used, that the botanical knowledge which goes along with it, along with the speakers, is lost. But also there can be a big consequence for the speakers, of course. And I've seen it, for example, described that losing one of your languages is like being locked out of a house that you live in. You no longer have the key. You can't get in. You can't speak to people in that language. So the consequences for the speakers can be quite devastating in that they no longer able to use their native language. They had to switch to another language in order to get an education or to find a job or whatever. There's a story told by an American linguist called Peter Ladefoged about a speaker in Kenya, and the father was, I think, bilingual in Dahalo, the local language, and Swahili. And Swahili is a language which is spoken very widely in Eastern Africa in particular. And it's, I guess if you want an education, you want to get on in your career, then speaking Swahili is probably very advantageous. And the father in this case was rather proud that his son only spoke Swahili and didn't speak Dahalo. And Ladefoged, the linguist who recounted this, his comment was, who am I to say that he was wrong? But there are reasons why some people do want to or had to switch to only speaking one language, the sort of dominant language, not the local language. Perhaps you can want to discuss that in the discussion period. Can a dead language be revived? The answer to that is yes. That's why some people prefer to talk about languages being dormant rather than dead or extinct. Cornish, for example, has been revived to some extent. I'm not sure quite how much, but the fact that a language no longer has native speakers doesn't mean that that's a permanent situation. Languages can be revived to some extent, at least. Okay, that's the end of the first part of my talk on the death of languages. Let me just have a little sip of water. Okay, before I go on to talk about the birth of the new languages, some people will say that these new languages are not really new, and you'll perhaps see why that is. I'm not really going to discuss that. So I'm going to talk about two kinds of language, pidgins and creoles. I'm going to begin by looking at definitions of these. Then I look at some examples of how pidgins and creoles come into existence. Then I look in a bit more detail at creoles, and there'll be a few linguistic examples there. I don't want this talk to be too general and abstract. Okay, so a pidgin is what happens, as in that Yvonne Mattress definition there, where people want to communicate with each other, but they don't have a language in common. So they may sort of invent something which uses bits of the various languages that they each speak without having a language in common. Whereas a creole happens, or creole emerges, when a pidgin is acquired as a native language by new speakers. It's a bit controversial precisely how this happens, and I'll come back to that definition later on. But let's begin by looking at an example of pidgins, that's to say languages that arise when two lots of people want to talk to each other, but they don't have a language in common. And there are two main context in which pidgins emerge. The first is trade, and I'll talk briefly about that. And the second one is indentured labour and slavery. And I'll talk in more detail about that, because that's where creoles emerge. We'll look at Russonorsk as an example of a trade pidgin. In the 1800s, Russians brought timber to Norway, and since the Russians didn't speak Norwegian, the Norwegians didn't speak Russian, they communicated by what has become known as Russonorsk, a sort of very basic language which took words from both languages of just, trading over what the price of a log of wood would be and so on. There were also, for example, the other side of Russia, there was a Russian-Chinese pidgin used in trade as well. So there are trade pidgins, but they tend to be very basic, and they tend to be very short-lived as well, because when the trade stops, the pidgin stops and says it no longer has any use at all. But that's not the case with the other kind of pidgins, the ones that involve indentured labour and or slavery, they can be much more long-lasting, or languages related to them can be much more long-lasting. The most, well, there are a number of examples, but the most obvious example of a pidgin and then a Creole emerging in slavery conditions is the slave trade from Africa to the Caribbean. And on the slave ships, and I think in the plantations too, the slave traders and slave owners, they deliberately mixed together people who came from different parts of Africa and presumably spoke different languages. So it would be difficult for them to communicate with each other and rebel against what they were being forced to do. And what would happen would be that the slave traders and then the plantation owners would communicate with the slaves in a pidgin English, perhaps. I should have said that the Creoles are mainly based, we'll see what I mean by based on European colonial languages, English, French, Spanish, Dutch. There are a few other examples, some based on Arabic, I believe, but I don't know anything about those. And the idea, this is all rather controversial, I'm not going to go into the different possibilities, that what would happen would be that the plantation owners would communicate with the slaves in, say, pidgin English, and then eventually, perhaps, the pidgin would be transformed into a Creole, which was a native language. And going back to that quote from Matras earlier on, he says, the subsequent generation for whom the pidgin served as the principal input language in infancy. Now, it's rather controversial as to whether Creoles emerged, were created by children or by adults. And I don't really want to go into that because I don't know what the answer is. I don't think anybody really knows for sure. Plus, it may be the case that some pidgins became Creoles in one way and others became Creoles in another way. So the idea is that somehow pidgins, which are rather limited languages, that they have rather limited vocabularies, and you can only talk about, say, the price of wood, or you can say, get that job done or whatever, and don't talk back to me and that kind of thing. They became somehow fully fledged languages with their fuller vocabulary. And for example, we'll look at an English-based Creole subsequently, and a French-based one as well. So, as I say, there are different views on how pidgins became Creoles, but I think it's difficult to disagree with this John McWhorter quote. Most Creoles have arisen amid conditions of unthinkably stark and ineradicable social injustice, and that is, well, slavery. I mean, there may be some which weren't quite that bad, but they are still pretty appalling, really, that that's really where Creoles have arisen. The most widely spoken Creole nowadays is Haitian Creole, spoken in Haiti, which has around 10 million speakers. I think that it has, in official terms, it has equal status in Haiti with French, but that's the legal position. It doesn't mean it necessarily has quite the same status in fact. Okay, I'm going to go on and look at some examples of Creoles, and some of these are as used in Dudley, which I think is somewhere near Birmingham, I don't know where it is. What I'm going to say about this is taken from a book which was based on research done back in the 1980s, so some of this may no longer be precisely valid, but I think in general that the principles are basically okay, and it was certainly true at the time when it was done. So this is Jamaican, well, patois is the sort of common term for the Jamaican Creole as used in the UK. I guess that this is slightly closer to English than Jamaican Creole as spoken in Jamaica, which we're going to see an example of shortly. But just to give you some idea of how similar to English this is, and also some of the ways in which it differs. So Jamaican patois in Dudley. It doesn't have the th sound, found in the English word thick. So the word for that is tick. So T, T in place of th. John swim fast rather than swims. As you'll be seeing, Creoles very often have rather simpler word structure. So there's no subject-verb agreement between John and swim there. I guess this is because they derive from a pigeon, and pigeons tend to be much simpler. So there's no subject-verb agreement. John swim fast, not swims fast. Aldi book, again, no plural in book. That's all the books. And just as there is no th sound, so there's no the sound either. So the is replaced by D, Aldi book, all the books. Winston C. Du Bois, again, the past tense is just C, not saw, and it's D, D boy, the boy. D man happy, the man is happy. There's no verb to be, the man happy. This is not uncommon in other languages, so it is not a purely Creole characteristic, not having a verb to be in a sentence like the man is happy or John is a socialist or whatever. Yeah. You don't need the verb to be in that kind of situation, and many languages don't use it, and Jamaican patois doesn't. And just as a last example there, the boy no want it, the boy doesn't want it, a much simpler sort of way of expressing negation, a bit like the boy not want it. You don't have to add this extra verb do, which we do in English. Okay, that's obviously a very superficial glance at some of the differences, but also some of the similarities. And as I said, I think Jamaican patois in the UK is rather closer to English than, as it were, the Jamaican Creole spoken in the West Indies, which we're going to see an example of in a second. Yeah, okay. So I've got some examples here from Jamaican Creole, which is English-based, and also then an example in a French Creole, Indian Ocean Creole, that's to say, as spoken in Mauritius, Seychelles, and so on. And these two examples illustrate verbs of giving. And in English, verbs of giving allow two constructions. I can say John gave the book to the boy, or I can say John gave the boy the book. Two different constructions expressing the same meaning. But Jamaican Creole only has the John gave the boy the book construction. Creoles in general don't, English-based Creoles don't have a construction like John, like I gave the book to the boy. So this is the way of saying in Jamaican Creole, Sarah gave the woman her hat. Sarah gi, give, da uman de, I sort of get in the pronunciation, da meaning the, as we saw earlier, uman woman. The de appears to be some kind of demonstrative, a meaning like that, but in the source I got this from, it just translated as the woman, and im, I suppose, is from him, but hat, him meaning her, and maybe there's no distinction between men and women in terms of pronouns, I'm not sure, okay? So Sarah gave the woman her hat. Sarah, again, guessing pronunciation, Sarah gave the woman her hat. Yeah. Okay, let's go and look at an Indian Ocean Creole based on French. I said English has two possible constructions for verbs of giving. I gave the book to John. I gave John the book. And also we have, I sent an email to Mary, or I sent Mary an email. But French doesn't have those two possibilities. In French, you can only say, I gave the book to John. You don't have the I gave John a book construction. But Indian Ocean Creoles, based on French, I think French Creoles more generally, they only had the gave John a book or sent Mary an email kind of construction. So he will send Mary a gift in Indian Ocean Creole, Li Pu Envoie Raj Mary en cadeau. Li is he, I assume, related from Louis, the pronoun. Pu is the future marker. It's derived from the French preposition pour, meaning for. I'm not quite sure how it evolved in meaning that, but there's no, French has a separate future tense marker, and there's no future tense on the verb in French-based Creoles. Normally, instead, there's this separate word, rather like will in English, perhaps. Mary Encado sent Mary the gift. I should have said that French nouns had grammatical gender, masculine and feminine, but French-based Creoles don't. They don't have a distinction between, you know, a nom and une femme. They just have they don't have a different gender for nouns. So, in some ways, the Creoles are, again, this is a bit controversial, they tend to be a bit simpler than the languages that they are derived from. So no gender, simpler verb systems, and so on, and so on, simpler noun systems, no explicit plurals and so on, yeah. Okay, let's look a little bit more at what happens in Dudley, which we saw earlier. Yeah. Apparently, again, this is from a book dealing with the situation 40 years ago, so I don't know if it's still the case. In Dudley at the time, the parents spoke patois to their kids, but the kids were expected to speak English to their parents, which is, in a sense, a slightly odd situation, that the sort of dominant language was more for the kids rather than for the parents, which is perhaps a bit unusual, but that was the situation, apparently, yeah. Now, many Creole societies have what's called a post-Creole continuum. Sorry, I've tried to keep out too much technical vocabulary, but you just have to make do with that one. That's to say, between the Creole and the dominant language, English, there is a whole range of different possibilities. So I didn't get the ball, the sort of deepest Creole is something like me no get the ball. Me, from the object pronoun, me, no, the simple way of saying, expressing negation that we saw earlier, and de, for the. But then there are lots of other possibilities too. Me never get the ball, which is closer in English to I never understood that idea, you know, never being there, yeah. And then the closer to the English word, especially negation, me didn't get the ball, didn't, din for didn't. And then replacing me with ah, which is closer to I never get the ball, and I didn't get the ball. And the last one there is not quite English, as it were, but it's very close to it. So there's this post-Creole continuum in, not just in Jamaica, but in other Creole societies too. However, apparently in Dudley, at least, and I don't know how wide that is, there wasn't, at the time that research was done anyway, a post-Creole continuum. There was either the Creole or something, well, it wasn't quite standard English. I assume it had some terrible Groningen accent, but something similar to standard English anyway. With nothing in between, really, yeah. And the suggestion that was made in the book I got this from was that black people in Dudley at the time were very much at the bottom of the social hierarchy. They weren't able to sort of get an education and become better off, get better jobs and so on. And you can see, I guess, how that might have been the case. So whether it's still true, I don't know. That's the situation 40 years ago. And it may well be that black people have become rather more socially mobile well, to some extent anyway, since then. Okay, so that's all I have to say really about pidgins and creoles, but I have something to say in a conclusion. Yeah, this is a quote, doesn't quite fit on the screen, I'm afraid, from the website of the Linguistic Justice Foundation. The hyphen in the website name there is not in the original, that's just there because that's the way it looks on the screen. Yeah. So I'll just read this. I know we don't like the term justice, but I think you can reformulate this without the word justice. Linguistic justice exists when people are respected equally, no matter how they choose to communicate. Linguistic justice means that people have access to the resources they need to communicate in the ways they prefer. And linguistic justice ensures everyone can participate meaningfully in decision-making, regardless of the languages they prefer to use. So, for example, this might mean that people should not be discriminated against because of their accent. People should not suffer because they need to have an interpreter in some context. It's also true that the majority of languages have a little or no online presence. So if you want to become sort of computer savvy, you may well need to learn a dominant language, because your own local language or native language, there aren't really websites or anything else in that. Okay, again, that might be something that you'd like to discuss in the discussion session. Okay, that's the end. Thank you. I believe that the Haitian Creole for thank you is merci. In Jamaican Creole, it's nuff said. So merci, nuff said. Thank you.